Hi, everybody. My name's Matthew. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Matthew. You?
Bill, alcoholic.
Hey, Bill.
Jay, alcoholic.
Hey, Jay.
Welcome to Kitchen Table Sobriety. It is not modesty or anything else but sincerity to tell you that it is our pleasure to be here. We enjoy this town, and we enjoy the sobriety here, and we're really grateful we were invited out, even if we did kind of invite ourselves. We're glad someone took the hint. But what we'd like to do tonight, just to start it off, this is a weekend of workshops on sponsorship, is just kind of let you know what got us to Alcoholics Anonymous. We thought we'd do an hour of what it was like, what happened, and how our lives started to improve. Then we're going to take a break. Then we're going to do an hour of what happened next, when the other shoe drops in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, Bill, did you want to say anything?
Yeah, what he said.
Yeah. He doesn't do that often.
And I'll be quiet.
Okay. Oh, yeah. We're going to spend a few minutes in meditation. If Zach will get off his phone and sit down. Let's hear it for Zach.
Yay! And Ben and Brent.
Yeah.
And Royce the wheel man.
Royce the man.
He was driving us back from the airport, and he ran out of gas.
Gotta love AA, man.
It's Nolens, man.
You belong in this room, miss.
Yeah,
come on.
Sit down. You belong in here.
Certain truths we hold to be self-evident.
So we're going to do some meditation, so let's make sure everyone's in.
Bring you greetings from a couple of different groups. One is the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag, and the other one is the 11th Step Group in Manhattan Beach, California. Both of those meetings have been going since at least 1948. They have a little bit of experience. And in the 11th Step Group, one of the things that we learned over the years is that 3 minutes of being quiet will change your life. Just 3 minutes. And we're in the postmodern era. You can be late to anything. 3 minutes, okay? So you got the time, all right? So now, even this morning, I had the good fortune of meditating with a friend, and she was saying, well, I thought I was doing it wrong because my mind was supposed to be silent. That's not it. And just sitting quietly with your eyes closed is perfection. The only wrong way to meditate is not to meditate. Okay?
So you're going to time it?
I'm going to say 3 minutes. If you want to do that, counselor.
Yeah, I'll do the time.
You know, I mean, I'm good with whatever flows out, you know. Might be 3 minutes and 12 seconds.
I'm not comfortable with
might
that.
Might be it's 2:48.
I don't want to over-meditate.
I'm completely uncomfortable sitting in between these two guys.
Well, Bill has been over-meditated before, so.
Yeah. Usually something Cuban was involved.
So if you guys would just take a second, be still, get comfortable. Go ahead, Jake.
Thank you.
So, like I said, my name is Matthew, and I have alcoholism. Can everybody hear okay? My sobriety date is May 16th, 1993, so that makes me the newcomer and the panel. I want to tell you a little bit about what it was like, so I can let you guys know that I'm alcoholic like you are, if you're here for that. And I'd really like to tell you about what happened and what the progression has been like. And fortunately, we have a few days to get really into that. But May 16th, 1993 is my sobriety date. And a snapshot of May 1st, 1993 was things weren't going so well. I weighed 108 pounds, and I know that because a few days later I got checked into a facility and they weighed me. I wasn't checking my weight on a daily basis in May, but I was avoiding things like that. And I lived in an apartment right near the ocean in Redondo Beach that I hadn't paid rent on for a while. So as a result, I was paying part of the rent because I had a roommate that would send me a check. He lived in another country for a while. But I wouldn't answer the door. I didn't answer the phone. I hadn't worked in 6 or 7 months. I'd been fired from a job that was beneath me. Anybody else fired from a job that was beneath them? Yeah. The great part about that is we took the job that was beneath us before we got fired from it. And it was... The situation on the outside of my life was that about 2 or 3 miles away, my mother and father lived, and who I loved and respected and were always kind and loving to me. And my mother was dying of cancer. And I sometimes, when I had some clarity, if I woke up and I wasn't inebriated yet, or if it was a decent hour and I missed my mother, I would call her and say, I'm coming to visit you. And I can tell you honestly, in front of all of you people, I really thought when I said that I was going to go visit her. But I know from my experience and looking back on it that I called her in that 6 or 7 months, maybe 25 or 30 times, and told her I was coming over, and I never went to the house. And I know what happens in that situation, because my mother and father aren't alcoholics, but my brother, who's 7 years older than me, used to say he was going to come over for Sunday dinner with his wife and child, and there were always 3 empty chairs at Sunday dinner, and my mother would cry, and my father would swear and pace around. So I knew it was happening. The job that I had been fired from was I was a restaurant manager, which I hated. And I was probably the worst restaurant manager in the history of restaurant management. But
it's true.
I mean, they did go out of business, but a safe amount of time after I was fired that I didn't make amends to the whole corporation for it. But you know, the way I managed that restaurant, I didn't respect that job. What had happened was I was playing in a band on the East Coast, and I got kicked out of the band. And to save face, I told everybody I'd moved back to Los Angeles because my mother had cancer. And as you already heard, that was a lie. But I got this job, and I used that restaurant job in the way I used everything and how it would best make me feel good on a moment-by-moment basis. So I looted the bar of alcohol whenever I got a chance. I took advantage of the 18-year-old waitresses, and I was 31 years old. I slept in my office many, many times through my shifts. I was sloppy with the finances, although I never stole money from them. But I was sloppy with the finances, and I was just terrible. And the day they fired me, I had one of the waitresses come up to me and said, I'm pregnant. And I hate to say this because I'm going to alienate the women in the room, but I want to be honest, and I also want to put this into context. I'm not running for president. I'm sharing it in Alcoholics Anonymous. Although today I think I could share this and still run for president. But if you had lined up the girls at Marie Callender's and said, which one of them do you want to accidentally get pregnant, I would have said, not her. And And it's even worse than you think, because I was 31 years old and she was 18, and my version of that story would have been, she's selfish and self-centered. That's terrible. It can't be her. And she came and said, I'm pregnant. I walked upstairs to some meeting they were having in my honor, and I got fired. And Bill likes it when I tell this part of the story, so I'll tell this part of the story. I walked out, and I slammed the door of the back door into the employee parking lot, pretending I had a car in the employee parking lot, because I had dignity, right? I had car keys in my pocket. I just didn't know where the matching car had been for quite a while. And I snuck around in my righteous indignation around to the street, across the street on Pacific Coast Highway in Hermosa Beach. And oddly enough, to a bus stop that's right in front of the Ilano Club that I later got sober at, and that's how I know these guys, but I didn't know it was there. But also next to there is a civic center. And at that civic center, they teach these autistic and chromosomally challenged people who are in their young adults how to live on their own, right? So how to, like, cook and pay their bills and transportation things. So I walk over there crying with snot coming out of my nose. I haven't drawn a sober breath in several months. And this is before I got, this is right the day I got fired. I had a tie on and my Marie Callender's manager badge. And I wanted to die. And I stood at this bus stop, and the bus just couldn't come fast enough. And there were about 8 or 9 of these challenged young adults with me. And I stepped off the curb to see if the bus was coming. And these 9 people yelled, "Don't stand on a tree! Don't stand on a tree!" And they scared the crap out of me. Like, I thought they saw a bus. Because I was seeing things and not seeing things that were there and seeing things that weren't there, and I thought they saw a bus, and I jumped back on the curb safely, thanks to them. And I thought, you know, I have 2 degrees, and they can wait for a bus better than I can. You know, they're better at it. And I got in the bus, and I wanted to go home and kill myself with alcohol. And so that's what happened. And 6 months later, or 7 months later, this girl's really, really pregnant, you know. I'm not visiting my mom and dad. I haven't answered the door. I walk next door to the liquor store. I'm pawning my guitars now, the things that meant the most to me in the world. I can't, you know, and I think back, because sometimes we get a story about what it was like before we got here, and we kind of stick to that story. But I think about my before sobriety time, when my birthday's coming up, and my birthday is May 16th. So I can tell you, if I were just to describe what it was like for me, and I don't know if it was what it was like for you, but the worst part wasn't all this stuff on the outside. The worst part was I couldn't trust myself to do anything but make my life worse. And I knew that from observing what was happening. I would do the compulsive thing that was going to make me feel better on a moment-to-moment basis, no matter what. Once the thought answered and went into my head, I was going to execute that. And every day, particularly in acceleration after the bottom was coming, I just made it worse. And the worst feeling in the world is, first of all, I think I'm losing my mind because I'm seeing things that aren't there, and I'm not seeing things that are there. I'm hearing things that aren't happening. But secondly, I know that the worst friend I've got in the world is me. And yet I don't want to talk to you. I don't want you to come to my door. I don't want you to call me on the phone. Does anybody else feel like that? So that's what it was like in May of 1993. And I can't tell you how much it hurts me that I did not go see my parents. My mother was really, really sick. And my father was devoted to my mother. They were married when they died almost 50 years. This is about 45 years they've been married at that time. And my mother and father were a living example of kindness and Christianity. My father and mother worked 2 jobs. My mother worked a job so that I could go to college. My brothers and sister and I could go to college. They were always kind and forgiving. My mother helped me become a rock and roll musician because she knew I wasn't a good athlete. She knew I didn't fit in with everybody, and she bought me a guitar. Not her choice, not what she wanted for me. But my father treated her with kindness and respect, and my mother taught me how to respect women. And when that girl was 8 and a half months pregnant, I pushed her down a flight of stairs. And I didn't do that because I wanted to hurt her. I can honestly tell you, I did not want to hurt her. I didn't want to hurt that baby. Who would want to hurt an unborn baby? I didn't.
But what happened was she wanted me to go to the doctor later that day, and she wanted me not to drink that day, and I'd been up all night. And what I heard was her yelling at me. And she wasn't yelling at me. She was being perfectly rational and reasonable. And I pushed her out of the doorway, and I knew I pushed her too much, so I slammed the door so I didn't have to watch the consequences. So that's what it was like for me. I came here. I came into my life. I had a good life. I had every advantage. And I like to say that about my parents because I go to a lot of AA meetings, and I know not everybody had the good fortune I had, and I want to honor my mother and father. You know, my alcoholism is not their fault. I'm Irish Catholic, and that's their fault. And there's some genetic predisposition. So anyway, on May 16th, 1993, to hurry up with what happened is, about May 14th, my brother called. And my brother was a terrible raging alcoholic from 14 on. And now he was sober, 12 years. And he called and said, it's Mother's Day tomorrow, and I want to make sure you're going to show up. And I didn't know why he would say, I want to make sure you're going to show up, because why would he think I'm not going to show up? I forgot I was calling. And he said, and I know you're having car trouble, meaning I have keys. And he said, I'll come pick you up. And he said, please make an effort. It's Mom's last Mother's Day. She's sick. And I didn't make an effort. I thought I would. That was the plan. But I stayed up all night drinking by myself. And when they came to the door, my brother came to the door, I combed my dirty hair and put on a clean shirt and walked out the door because I didn't want him to see my apartment. And I'll tell you why I didn't want him to see my apartment. Somebody in New York described this perfectly. You know, if alcoholism came into your life like a whirlwind and took everything in a week or two, we'd all come to AA. But alcoholism doesn't do that. Alcoholism takes a bite and you adjust down, and another bite and you adjust down. And someday you wake up and you're living in squalor and you don't even know it. Yeah. And I looked around my apartment and there were so many things I couldn't explain because I'd been living there by myself. There were, I don't know if you guys do this, but there were blankets on the windows to keep out the SWAT team. Remember? The SWAT-proof blankets? There were bottles on the floor. I was making collages late at night with X-Acto knives and questionable magazines that somebody left on my porch, so I added them to my art collection. I just was living like Gollum in there. I went outside... Thought I cool, I covered my tracks. He didn't see my apartment. He can't know what's going on with me. I did not know I weighed 108 pounds. I didn't know you could see my skeleton. And I got in his car and he was quiet. I proceeded to destroy my mother's last Mother's Day, or what we thought was her last Mother's Day, through inappropriate behavior. I have no idea what I did or said. And my brother took me home and a fight broke out when he drove on the way home. And he drove off, and I got so mad at him that I called him to finish the fight. And after I yelled and screamed at him for a while, there was silence on the other end of the phone, and my brother did something that many people had done. But I believe, and Bill told me long ago, that grace is an unwarranted gift. And I think there was a moment of grace that happened, and what happened was he said, I think you have a problem with alcoholism. That's not the grace. I had that put to me many times, not by family members. But I said, unbeknownst to me that I was about to say it, I said, of course I do. And I didn't, I just said it. And I know now that I worked the first step. I admitted something. I surrendered a little. And my brother rushed to my house. Funniest thing he said, before he hung up the phone, he said, don't go anywhere. I said, oh, okay. I was going to move to that end of the couch in the spring. But you got plans. So he came over and he brilliantly 12-stepped me. And I maybe we'll get into that tomorrow. But so he said, on the way back, he said, I gave up. I surrendered. And I said, you know what, man? You're right. I need to go to AA. We're sitting on a lifeguard stand at the beach. And he said, dude, you're not going to AA. You're going to a hospital. And I looked him right in the eye and totally seriously, I said, I can't do that. I'm busy.
And I thought I was busy. Any of you guys in the back row too busy to go to the hospital? Great. I know, right, right. And 30 days of not sitting on the couch and not answering the phone and not paying my bills seemed like a long time, because that's what I was busy doing. But May 16th, 1993, the phone rang. It wasn't my brother, but I didn't know that, so I answered the phone thinking he's taking me to rehab. And it was a woman who I used to be able to say I didn't know who it was, but I met her at a party 3 years ago, 19 years later. And she said, "Your daughter was born today." And I ran to find my car and wearing what I'd woken up on the floor with. I had a t-shirt on that had a big gulp, and I'd fallen backwards and passed out on a big gulp, so I was stuck to my back. I had OR scrubs on and flip-flops. I was all dressed up to go to the maternity ward and meet my child, and who I had forgotten about. And I found my car, an AMC, and I took the tickets off the front of the car and threw them in the back seat, and I drove to the wrong hospital. I drove to the hospital where I was born, because I'm selfish and self-centered. And that's where babies come from. And then I went and put my head on the steering wheel, and I realized where they were, and I drove to the right hospital, and I ran up to the room, and I so wish this story were different. I so wish I could tell you that I ran and found them, and I had an awakening, and I saw the beauty of it, but I didn't prepare myself for what was happening. And I ran into the hospital room, and Anna jumped up, and she looked really weird. Has anybody ever seen anyone who's just had a baby? They look like a Picasso, like their eyes are on the wrong side of their nose, and their boobs are like willow trees. But I can also tell you that she looked more beautiful than I'd ever seen her look. She had a light coming out of her, and she was breathtakingly beautiful. And I was ugly and filthy and dirty, and it was so loud in my head because she looked so great. And I thought she was going to hug me, and I didn't want that to happen. And she ran over and stopped before she hugged me, and she pulled out this baby out of a little glass rectangular box named Phoebe Rose. And she handed me Phoebe Rose, and I looked at Phoebe Rose. She was equally beautiful and pure and innocent and perfect. And I was worse than when I looked at Anna. And I wanted to get home and put that gun in my mouth. That's how I felt the day I met my child. So I ran out of that hospital praying that those two people would never see me again, heading home to shoot myself. And my brother was sitting on my porch with a suitcase in his hand and said, "Get in the car, I packed your stuff." Thank God. And I told him my daughter was born, and he didn't ask me how she was, what her name was, if she was healthy. He just looked at the ground in sadness because he thought I was going to die. And we went to rehab, and that's what it was like. And what happened was I got home, and 30 days later, my brother drops me off, and he said, "Hey, go to a meeting." And I lied and said, "That's what I was going to do." Because who's going to go to a meeting? I've been in the hospital for 30 days. I'm going to go see my mom. I'm going to go see my daughter. I'm going to get a job. I got a lot to do. I'm 30 days sober. I'm invincible. I'm bulletproof. I went through all the steps in the hospital. And I walked up to my door and opened the door, and somebody handed me a beer. It wasn't a beer. It was a Coors. You guys are from New Orleans. That's not a beer. And they were doing all sorts of drugs in my house. And I backed out of that house, and I put that beer on the curb, and I ran to an AA meeting. And I'll tell you honestly why I did that. I did not have a moment of grace. I did not have, well, maybe I did. I did not have a foundation of recovery. I did not have a relationship with a higher power. I had 30 days, man, and that's all I had. I had no respect of my friends or my peers. Everyone wanted to kill me. I had debt everywhere. I couldn't trust myself to make the right decision. I'm not giving up the one thing I had on those guys. So I ran to a payphone, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's what happened. I got very involved very early through the grace. I went to meetings where we didn't celebrate the birthdays. We celebrated fifth steps. I went to a step study. So I wanted to do a fifth step. I went to meetings where I got my sponsor, and he directed me in meetings. I ended up going, this is embarrassing to say because my son's in the room, but I ended up going to almost exclusively men's stag meetings because I was at a mixed meeting at noon in the back room at the club. And there was a girl sitting next to me, and she had a men's suit vest on and nothing underneath it, which I noticed right away. And she had these little khaki pants on. She had this little short blonde hair, and she was about 22 years old, which I was about 31 years old, so it was perfect. And I looked at her, and she shared and said, God, I'm 16 days sober, and all I can think about is sex and chocolate. So then I looked at nothing else but her. And then it came to me a few people later, and I said, my name's Matthew, and I thought I'd be funny, and turned to her and said, and I'm made of chocolate. And my sponsor grabbed me and said, we're going to go to the Monday Night Men's Stag. And that's how I met these guys. And just to wrap this up, what happened? I got really involved. I went to lots and lots of panels. I did the step straight through without stopping and without hesitation, because that's what I thought everybody did. I met people that said, we're going to do this, we'll pick you up. We're going to do this, we'll pick you up. When I went to court, they were standing there with me. I had a beautiful life unfold. I met a beautiful woman. I married her. I raised Phoebe. Phoebe's exactly as old as I am sober. She's going to be 23 this May. I had two more children. We traveled all over the world. We had just an amazing life. And that's all I need to tell you right now. Thanks. All right.
Bill Alcoholic. Did anybody cry? I've been listening to him for years, and I just, God, you know, that's a pathetic story.
And I know.
Mine's a bit different. Basically, I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy. And I never went to the beach. My motorcycle rarely ran, and I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat and a primary chain for a belt and black greasy Levi's and big black boots with chains around them. I've got tattoos all over me. But I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself. And, I think that's pretty much all you really need to know. That's the story, really. And one of the things I like to talk about a little bit is every story that you hear, whether it's somebody just sharing in a meeting or giving a talk, usually what will happen is the speaker will talk about how long before he or she was ever sober, they didn't feel part of. They felt separate, odd, and geeky, and out of place, and couldn't throw the ball, couldn't, you know, there's something about it. I mean, we have cute ways of expressing it, like, you know, the aliens had dropped me off, and I'm waiting for the mothership to return, you know, that kind of stuff. And we talk about that like it's some kind of unique experience, like we're the only ones that have that. Like it's an aspect of alcoholism. And I don't know, I've had experience at raising kids, and I think all kids feel that way. It's part of growing up. You know, when they, prior to puberty, you know, I mean, they start stretching their muscles, they start pushing the envelope, you know, and they realize that you don't understand, nor will you ever understand what's going on with them. You just randomly tell them they can't do things, and they just get pissed, you know, because they want to do stuff, and you won't let them, you know. So you are clearly not on their side, you know, and they start pushing. Then they hit puberty, and it escalates. It can get really interesting, you know. And then somewhere along the line, they begin to grow out of that. They get a little more mature. They deepen emotionally. Relationships start to smooth out, and somewhere kind of in their early to mid-20s, they kind of mellow out, and they start making a life for themselves. We skipped that part. You know, we medicated through that whole thing. The difference between us and these other kids is we never grew up. And we walk into Alcoholics Anonymous, and we're going to grow up now. And the chances of us doing that and looking good are really slim, because we're a little late. And the other part of the story that's similar between most all speakers is we have a couple of drinks and that feeling goes away. I mean, to me, there's two aspects to alcoholism. One is, and I don't know that everybody has this, is that there's a physiological aspect to it. There's a part of it that when we drink, it sets something off, and we have no control over when or if we're going to stop and how much we're going to consume. You know, that is very real. It certainly is real with me and in my family. I can see my father's side is just riddled with alcoholism. And the other aspect of it is that we get a bang out of it that other people don't get. I mean, if they got the kick out of it that we got, they would definitely drink more, you know. And I think we have a spiritual awakening. We have a life-changing experience. I mean, that feeling goes away. We clearly get smarter, better looking, taller, more buff. You know, it's like everything changes. And then we go about the business of, for however long, chasing that and chasing it and chasing it and chasing it. One of the things that you'll hear when people tell this aspect of feeling separate is they'll use a term called alcoholic thinking, as if there is such a thing. You know, I mean, you repeat stuff around here often enough, people just pick it up like, oh, yeah, it's on page 34, you know. It's like, you know, you look for it. I've not really found it, you know. My wife and I were over in Europe somewhere standing on this beautiful coastline, and we're overlooking this view, and it's just gorgeous. And she says to me, you know, if we smoked a joint right now, it would enhance this experience. I think that could very well be alcoholic thinking. You know? I mean, there is some truth to it, you know. Who else wants to enhance an already very enhanced experience, you know? You know, we can change our reality. We have a desire for that kind of thing. And the professional community never uses that term alcoholic thinking. You know what they say about us? They say that we are emotionally immature. And we hear that and we just go, no, I have special thinking. You know, I have alcoholic thinking and it's never going away. And you need to consider that when you're dealing with me. I just think we're emotionally immature. You know, I got here at 37, and on a good day, I had the emotional development of a 16-year-old, and this kid was not an honor student. He's not the one that's mature beyond his years, you know. He's the one with the problem with authority. I start drinking it, seriously drinking it around 14, maybe 15 years old. Somewhere in there, I finally got really hammered. And I started chasing it. By the time I'm 17, I'm a bad drunk in high school, and I'm walking around carrying a gun. And nobody's looking for me. You know, I mean, I'm a white kid from Palos Verdes. You know, I'm a middle-class dude, and there's no gangs where I come from. I don't have any idea where this came from. But gangster was really intriguing to me. And I pursued that and chased it. At 17, I'd already been to jail. You couldn't talk to me. I was just, if you had any authority at all, it just pissed me off for no apparent good reason. You know, and that followed me, has followed me through most of my life, well into sobriety. That feeling of the rules just don't apply to me. You can't tell me what to do. And you'll hear guys in AA, you know, 30, 40 years sober say, you know, don't tell alcoholics what to do. We don't like to be told what to do. Well, you know, when you're 14 or 15, that can be kind of appropriate, maybe even cute. When you're 40, it's just stupid, you know. I mean, part of life is there's always someone telling us what to do. And probably, what, 98% of the time, it's probably pretty good advice, you know. It's like, don't cross the street when there's cars coming. You know, I'll show them. You know, it's like, what is that? I think that's emotional immaturity. I think that's all it is. It's not some deep, profound, neurotic problem, you know. So at 17, I'm this bad drunk. At 22 years old, I'm in a mental institution. I needed a rest. You know, I mean, it was the 60s. It was exhausting. You know, there was a lot to do, and it all needed to be done. And, I was in Golden Gate Park during the Summer of Love. You know, I'm sorry I missed the experience. I mean, I was physically in places where all that was happening, and I truly kind of wasn't there. You know, I was getting hammered. That's what I was doing. And there'd be a march about something, so I'd get in line and march. I had no idea where the hell we were going, or but everybody was going that way, you know. And I met a woman. She had long brown hair and large mammary glands. And she smiled at me, you know, and we went to Oregon to grow our own. And we had two babies, two kids, and at 20, and I'm, at the time I went to the mental institution, I'm running with an outlaw motorcycle gang. I'm sticking needles in my arm every day. I'm drinking like a fish. I'm not coming home to that family. They're on welfare. We lost a house and a couple of cars and jobs, and we lost our souls, you know. And I ended up in a mental institution. And anybody else here been in a mental institution? Well, that's pretty good. There's probably some of you still out there going, well, it really wasn't an institution. They were just observing me. I went back for a follow-up. I kind of liked it. You know? The mental institution I was in was the Oregon State Mental Institution in Salem, Oregon. And it's where Ken Kesey worked when he wrote Cuckoo's Nest. They filmed that movie on the ward that I was on. Now, I'm not bragging, but it's all I got. This is the high point of the drunkalog. This is it. I've been up there doing conferences and stuff over time, and some of the guys up there made me a shirt. It's one of my prized possessions. It says, Oregon State Hospital Alumni. You know, and God. I came back down to L.A., and my sober dad, that got sober in 1954, and when he died, I grew up, on top of all my other problems, I grew up in an AA house. I don't recommend it, you know. I mean, potlucks just kind of break out, you know, all of a sudden. And, you know, these guys are starting meetings in central offices and stuff, and I grew up in that environment. So one thing I knew is I knew AA was okay. You know, because I knew the people. They were very close to Chuck Chamberlain and some of the people, and Clancy was the newcomer, and they all said he'd never make it, you know, and that kind of stuff. And they still say that about me. You know? And he gave me a job in his machine shop in El Segundo, and he let me sleep in his garage. And I tried to clean up my act. 15 years after the mental institution, I got sober. I could have very easily gotten sober at 22, or at 19 or 20. You know, I mean, I was ready. I had qualified already. And, you know, today all the kids are coming in now. And it's remarkable. You know, recovery is at all levels of our society now. You know, I've watched that. I was part of the first big influx or second. You were pretty fairly young in the late 70s of all this people coming in, you know. But I was 37, you know. I could have very easily gotten sober a lot earlier than that. But nobody ever talked to me about it that I can recall. You know, I don't know that I would have been receptive. It's not even worth speculating on it. But I met another woman. We got married. We had two kids. And at 37 years old, I lived in the house with this second wife and these two children, and I had no emotional connection to another living human being. And I didn't know that. I didn't know. I can't stand outside myself and have a separate experience and compare it to the one that I'm having to determine that there's anything wrong. I don't think any of us know the depth of our self-centeredness. And so on that particular day, which will be this coming Sunday, March the 27th, like any good gangster, I called my mom. And she had been in Al-Anon for 30 years by this time. They are prepared. And they're ready and focused. And she got there inside of half an hour, and she checked me into a place in Costa Mesa called Starting Point. And I spent 35 days in there. Now, I'm a product of the psychotherapeutic generation. I went to my first psychiatrist when I was 13 because of the rage. I just had horrible rage long before I ever started drinking or using or anything. I spent two tours of duty in the mental institution. I spent 2.5 years in group therapy at one time. I've been to several other therapists and shrinks over the years. So while I was in this hospital program, they made me wear a sign around my neck. I had to make the sign. We made it in crafts. And it's a little rectangular piece of cardboard with a string that went through it, and it said, "I am not a counselor." Because evidently there was some confusion about that. And then they let me out. They just let us out. Like we're okay now. You know? Go forth, multiply. You know, that's another thing. We can end alcoholism. We should not breed. This is not a good gene pool here. You know? And where do we end up when they let us out? Here. AA, the world's aftercare program. You know? I mean, the inmates are truly running the asylum. You know, we are the counselors. That's what we do. We counsel people, right? I mean, you stop and think about this. I've been married 3 times. I've been to a mental institution 2 times, and people ask me for relationship advice. I give it to them. I figure, hell, you can't hurt them. They're in AA, you know? I mean, this literally is the last house on the street. There's no referrals from AA. There's no place you go where you walk in and you say, "I'm from AA. They sent me here." I mean, this is it. You know, there's no plan B. You know? And we can go back to the old life. Lots of people do. Some of them come back. You know, some don't. Some die. Some people get sober in church. You know, some people stop. If they don't have the physiological aspect of it, I think some people just finally clean up their act. But for alcoholics, this is it. Now, 2 things happen that I think are just lucky. One is, I just liked it. I have no rational explanation for that, other than I just got intrigued right away. I just think you're absolutely fascinating. I love the stories. You know, I remember driving home that first night after I went to a meeting, and I went home and I thought, you know, this may not be so bad. Because at the Hermosa Beach Alano Club on Friday night, there was a meeting called the Gong Show. And a lot of people said it really wasn't an AA meeting. It probably really wasn't. I mean, it was just one heresy after another. And I'm an old hippie from the 60s. Weird has always been attractive to me. I move towards it, not away from it. You know, I mean, it's just, yeah, let's go find out what those people are all about, you know? And the second thing that happened is I asked a man for help, and he actually helped me, which doesn't always happen. You know, and like Matthew said, Matthew, same story. You know, he said to me, be at my house, and to be my sponsor. He says, be at my house Thursday at 5 o'clock, read the doctor's opinion, make notes in the margin of what you agree with and don't, and we'll discuss it. Now, I thought this was in the handbook. You know, I mean, how would you know any different? I didn't know any different. I thought this is what you were all doing. You know, I read my assignment. I show up at his house. He did not trust me that I'd read it, and he had me sit there and read it to him out loud. And we'll talk about this more over the weekend, but essentially, people think there's some weird kind of spooky secret handshake thing about sponsorship. No, you just read the book with them. That's it. And whatever conversation is going to come up will come up from that experience. And that's what happened. He guided me through the steps. He brought things to my attention. I underlined certain things, and we talked about stuff, and I had issues and problems, and he would give me airtime. You know, you ever hear people talk about all their problems in AA meetings? You know, where they'd go there, and I went in there, and I dumped, and I feel a lot better, you know? And those people don't have sponsors. They might have a buddy or a friend or something that they call sponsor, but they're not processing it. So we don't know any different. We come from the psychotherapeutic world. You know, this is group therapy. It's a support group, right? No. It's a really bad group therapy organization. It's a piss-poor support group, you know. The fellowship is something to be survived, you know. It will not keep you sober, you know. This is the character defect center of the known universe, you know. You stop and think about who you're asking advice from. Stop and think about where they've come from, you know. And if you do the program, then the fellowship can very much become like a warm blanket. You learn how to accept people just as they are and stuff. But initially, that's not so easy to do. Pretty soon, there's so many people that piss you off around the local area, you can't go to any meetings because they're all there. You know, and we'll borrow money from you and we won't pay you back, you know. We'll hit on your wife or do some really cute stuff, you know. And you'll give me a job and I'll do a crappy job and somehow it'll be your fault, you know. You ever heard somebody, every time I hear a guy go, my boss is a complete asshole, you know, and I think, you know, I bet he's just fine, buddy. He probably just told you to go pick that box up and move it over there, and he can't talk to me like that, you know. So I end up in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's been a long journey. That's what we want to spend the rest of the weekend talking about.
Jay Alcoholic.
Jay.
First of all, I want to thank everybody that had anything to do with organizing this thing. Could you raise your hand? Thank you, guys. Thank you, Jay. And then, you know, I want to thank you guys for taking time out of your week to come and join us. And we'll have a break for refreshments in a few minutes. But I want to tell you that the honor and privilege of coming here and being with you, we don't take lightly. Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life, and anything that I can do to be of help is a great, great privilege. I bring you greetings from my fabulous wife, Adele. Adele's sober 26 years, she's a great light in my life. I came to you on the second day of May in 1979, and although I found it necessary on a number of occasions, I haven't taken the front drink sniffed any glue or done any of those other things that I found to be so consoling. So I want you to know that you can do this thing one day at a time. Now, there's no difference in stories. You know, I mean, if that's not your story, it's no big deal. The important thing is that what happens when you make the decision and what comes from there. And so for me, I was living in my Pinto. For you younger folks, that was a smart car that Ford made for alcoholics in the 70s. Very uncomfortable. And, you know, I was the short guy in school. I can't throw the ball as far. I can't run as fast. But when I was 12 years old, I found something that I could do better than guys that were bigger and tougher and stronger and older than me. And that was metabolized beverage alcohol. Obviously, this is a gift from God. And when you're gifted, you have to use those gifts, right? And so I did. I was after it. Now, a lot of people, you know, they say, well, how do you know whether you're alcoholic or not? And I like to say, take what it is that you do for fun and then compare it to what happens when most of the population exhibits the same behavior. For example, by the time that I'm 16 years old, my idea of a good time was to take a rack of Reds, which was three high-powered sedatives, Secanol, and wash it down with a quart of Spinata wine. Now, in 90% of the population, those who don't have this odd physiological thing, if they do that, they end up in the hospital. They literally forget how to breathe. They throw up, they choke on their vomit, they die, and that's it. With me, I'm looking for car keys and to make short-term romantic commitments. Which brings me to another point about alcoholism as I experienced it. Have you ever woken up with a life form with which you were unfamiliar when you left the house that morning?
Yes.
Okay. And then continued to exhibit that behavior. Most normal people, if they wake up and go, oh, is it male? Is it female? And that's before it was hip. You know, and you go, ah! You know, and it's before cell phones, so you have to ask them for their phone number, and you pray that they write their name down, right? So that you can know what to call them. And, you know, so you develop these coping skills. Most people would go, I'm never doing that again. And yet I do it again and again and again and again and again. And I have no idea that what I'm doing is that once I take a drink, I am off to the races. Now, do I get in trouble every time? No, but every time I'm in trouble, I'm drinking. And I don't just drink. You know, I mean, I'm on all of it. Now, and when I say I'm alcoholic, I never put a needle in my arm that I didn't have a little drinky poo first, okay? And I'm not a hype, okay? And when I say that I kept going to jail, I'm not talking about jail. I'm talking about I couldn't go more than 4 months without somebody saying, get in the car, and taking me to jail, and just again and again and again and again and again. And I had no idea that what I was alcoholic. I thought what I was a bad guy getting what I deserved because I could not predict what would happen. And if you're a friend of mine, have you ever had this happen to you? You come home and she's changed the lock. And she's got the alcoholic luggage waiting for you. two hefty bags with all your possessions, you know, and you knock on the door and you say, hey, what's up? You know, and she's not out, open it, and finally you make enough racket that she opens it up, and she's crying. She said, where you been? Well, I've been busy. Doing what? And I have no idea that what happens is that, you know, she said, we were supposed to get together with my mother last night. And I have no idea that what happened was I took the front drink and I have the phenomenon of craving. What do I mean by the phenomenon of craving? What I mean is I go and I have a few pops with the boys on the way home. We keep drinking. We go to an after-hours place. We get some of that Peruvian marching powder. We drink all through the night. We go into a restaurant at 6 a.m. We have a few drinks, push some food around on a plate, get some more Peruvian marching powder, drink all through the day and into the night, and I'm home because it's the only place that's open. When I came in, they said it was like making love to a gorilla. We're not done until the gorilla says, finished. And I've got no idea. I think that I've made a conscious decision to do this instead of that. Everybody's telling me, you said you'd be here, and you're not. So you made a decision to do that. And that's not it at all. That's not it at all. Once I start to drink, I change my mind. The mind, once I take any substance in me at all, the mind changes, and the man who makes the decision is completely different than the man that started. Okay? And so I violated the trust of anybody that ever put any in me. And I end up, I'm in the Pinto. Great. I'd been arrested. I got arrested again, driving under the influence. My father was kind enough to bail me out and over a vodka rocks at a hotel in Santa Clara, California. He said, do you think you have the disease? And the still small voice inside of me said, pay really close attention. He might pay for the lawyer. So I said, I don't know. And he said, well, I got a friend that I'd like you to talk to. He said, you can go down to my mother's house, my grandmother Marie, who lived in El Segundo. He said, you can stay with her for a few days. He said, but I want you to talk to this guy. So I call this guy up, and he says, meet me at the Howard Johnson's at 7:30. Don't have anything to drink. And don't smoke any of that crap either. How did he know? How did he know? But I show up, and he talked about the problems in his life. And I had these problems in his life. And he came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and he didn't have any problems anymore. He's talking about himself and talking about himself and talking about himself. No problems in AA. No problems in AA. And after about 45 minutes, I just want to suck on a gun. When is this guy going to stop? And I figure, well, okay, he's not closing me. So I say to him, I prompt him. I say, do I need psychiatric treatment? Do I need religion? How about hospitalization? And he looks at me and he says, listen, Trick, if you or your family can get the $3,000 that it's going to cost for you to go on a treatment program, go out and drink that money up. And when you're done, call Alcoholics Anonymous. They do it for fun and for free. And then he got up. And he said, and if you want AA, kid, it's in the white pages of the phone book. You're going to have to go and get it just like you went and got your drugs and your alcohol. Good luck. And he left. He didn't even pay for my breakfast. So I went home to my grandmother's house. I got out a water glass and filled it with Davies County, Kentucky whiskey. And I called Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you want to see Alcoholics Anonymous? Can we help you? And I said, She said, do you have a problem with drinking? Well, I didn't really know if I had a problem with drinking, but there were a lot of people that had a problem with my drinking. And so I said, yeah. And she said, don't go. She said, are you drinking now? Well, I don't know about you guys, but I get very literal when people are at, you know, I mean, it, I wasn't pouring it down my throat, therefore I'm not drinking, right? And anyway, I said, so she said, don't go anywhere. And this guy calls me back and goes, hi, I'm Larry, I'm an alcoholic. Are you ready to get sober? And I, you know, and I ended up at a noon meeting at the Alano Club, Manhattan Beach, and I walked in at 12:30, and the woman behind the coffee bar said, "You upstairs." And I walked up into this meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and everybody starts talking at me. Now I can't understand why they're talking at me, but you see, when I've been out busy, it's been a while since I've clipped my fingernails, and when my hair is long, I look like the Sphinx. And I'm shaking. I got the zup-zups going because I haven't had enough to drink yet. And when I light a cigarette, it looks like a napalm strike's been called in. And they had somebody sit behind me with a spoon, a wooden spoon, in case I seized. Because in Alcoholics Anonymous in those days, you still had people doing flippy-floppy in the meetings. And what happened is that the third guy that talked was a guy by the name of Butcher Joe. You can always tell Butcher Joe. His name is Joe Hacker. You can't make this crap up. And he talked about when the family left, how he cried the big crocodile tears. And inside he's going, yes! Now we can drink. Nobody's going to mess with us. I understood that. And he talked about being at work and knowing just how deeply to cut himself so that they'd have to take him to the hospital and he could get the drink that he needed along the way. And see, I'd spent a lot of years tenant bar. Well, a lot of years. Hell, I'm 24 years old at the time. Been tenant bar for 5 years. And I knew how to get money if I didn't have any. And I'd walk into a bar and I'd set a bet up with the bartender and I would eat a beer glass. I'd say, I'll eat a beer glass. Who thinks I can't do it? People put their money down. And I'd split what we won because I'd start doing it. Nice thing about doing something like that is you only have to get about 8 bites before they just go, oh, my God, just give him the money. Because it's so...
stupid.
Repulsive.
And I haven't had to mutilate myself for 36 years. You know, so anyway, this guy said, he looked right through me and he said, you don't have to feel the way that you feel about yourself ever again if you're willing to do what I've done. And I came here from Sedona, Arizona to carry that message. That you don't ever have to feel the way that you feel about yourself ever again if you're willing to do what I've done. And that there is something here that is beyond comprehension. It is beyond definition, and it doesn't need to be. Now, I'd like to invite you to do just one little thing before I end here. And I'd like you to close your eyes. And I'd like you to think about, or somebody call out, what's the worst incurable disease that you know of?
Ebola.
Okay. Now, what if we got a bunch of people with that virus, and somebody says, there's a way out. 81 years ago, alcoholism and drug addiction is a death sentence, like Ebola. There's nothing that can be done. There is no cure. If you got enough money, maybe they can build a house and keep you there. That's it. But mostly what we end up is in institutions. And somebody says to you, there's a doctor in Akron. Or, you know, here it'd be like, there's a doctor in Lafayette. You know, and he's got a way out. Would you go? And we've got a way to treat it, and it's not medical. Although there is a component in it that's physical. Are you willing to go to any lengths to get it? And these women and men actually did that. And they passed it on to a guy like me. And I get to sit here with you tonight. This is a pearl beyond price. And open your eyes, please. I mean, This is, you know, if you're here and you're new, you have no idea what you've walked into. And I can tell you from down the road that it is a wondrous, wondrous place to be. That man that got up and walked out of that restaurant, I didn't realize it, but he'd had 10 years sober. And he had, at another point, 16 years sober. And he wasn't sober the day, as we would call it, he wasn't an AA member the day he came and had breakfast with me. But that man saved my life. It's the message. It's not the messenger. And what we're going to talk about tonight, over the weekend, is how do we absorb this message, and then how do we transmit it? And it is an adventure beyond your wildest dreams. Thank you.
So,